Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Summer in Sacramento, or California for that matter, really hasn't been the same the past couple years. The pandemic shut down a popular summer tradition, the California State Fair. During the height of the pandemic, portions of Cal Expo were transformed into safe housing for those experiencing homelessness, as well as a mass testing and vaccination site. But after a two-year hiatus, the State Fair is back. That smell of deep-fried food, corn dogs, cotton candy wafting over Cal Expo have returned, not to mention rides and entertainment. There are also new exhibits to check out, and also some new important rules aimed at keeping everyone safe. Joining us now is Rick Pickering, CEO of Cal Expo and the California State Fair. Good morning, Rick. You are muted, Rick.
Let's try this again. Yeah,
Take two. Good morning, Rick. The State Fair opened last Friday, so it's almost been a week. What have the crowds been like in the first 6 days or so?
People have been awesome. They've been excited. Lots of families coming out, large groups of multiple generation families coming out, celebrating getting California back together again.
Going back to really September, that's when the State Fair announced that it was coming back after a two-year hiatus. 10 months is an eternity, especially at a time during a pandemic, and we know how unpredictable things can be. How did you ride all of that out logistically?
Well, obvious. Well, most large event facilities were shut down beginning in March of 2020. The California State Fairgrounds, located at Cal Expo, was called upon by the governor and the administration to stand up in a variety of emergency functions. You've already listed many of those, but there were days when we were vaccinating more than 10,000 people a day, which is quite spectacular. We were sheltering individuals that had contacted with COVID, moving forward through a variety of emergency services, supporting the region, the state, and certainly the local community as well. But as far as weathering it, like most businesses, we laid off the majority of our employees. You know, that included roughly 800 to 900 part-time seasonal employees, 60% of our full-time employees. But we're able to keep the doors open as an emergency support facility. And then as the state began reopening, we were able to add some staff back in. I would say, like most businesses, finding great employees is a challenge right now. There are people willing to work, and we're proud to be able to give them jobs at the State Fair this summer. Hmm.
What does staffing look like now compared to the last time there was a State Fair back in 2019?
We have a lot less staff. We have more people coming out having a good time, but there are things the public is doing that's really helping us out. More people are purchasing their tickets in advance. The clear bag policy has allowed our admission lines, security lines to move much, much quicker. And the food festival, people just can't seem to get enough of exciting food items at the State Fair this summer. Food is phenomenal.
Yeah, you almost need like two or three stomachs to actually try everything at the State Fair and go over the course of days. You mentioned clear bags. And as we all know, the last several months in Sacramento has been incredibly traumatic with two high profile deadly mass shootings in our area. So let's just get to safety, which is no doubt at the top of your priority list. There are a handful of new rules in place this year. So let's run through them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, your California State Fair is designed to be family friendly. We market to moms and children and a large amount of diversity here in the region. And so we pride ourselves on being the safest square mile you can be at in July in Sacramento. And part of the policy we've had in place for a number of years, our what I would call rules of conduct, policies of conduct, you know, simple things like don't run, those types of things. Don't jump up and down on tables, even though people get excited at our concerts. We have some code of conducts in place this year. Looking at large event facilities across the nation and even here in California, we went ahead and enhanced some of those policies. We've had walk-through metal detectors in place for a number of years, but what we found, particularly coming out of COVID, was more facilities like the Kings, the River Cats, even our own Sac Republic team had gone to a clear bag policy, one, to try and lessen the spread of any germs that we learned about during COVID, but two, it's much, much quicker to go through a security line when you pick up a plastic, when somebody shows you both sides of their plastic bag, and then they can come on in and enjoy themselves. So that also helps with a shortage of staffing. when we just look at gate staff, ticket takers, ticket sellers. And the other thing we looked at is our absolute largest days are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And we can get anywhere from 60 to 80,000 regional folks coming out to the state fair on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then at night, it even gets more crowded as the temperature cools off. So we instituted, miners are always welcome every day of the fair, but on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night after 6 o'clock, when you're coming through the gates for admission, those miners need to be accompanied by somebody 21 year old and up that says, these young people are mine, I'm responsible for them. And you know, it's actually worked very, very well. Through this weekend, we had zero arrests, we had zero ejections, and we think both the clear bag and the new miner being accompanied by an adult policy has worked very, very well. And unfortunately, the situation that occurred at Knott's Berry Farm just a few days ago, it's generated a fair amount of social media saying, thank you, State Fair, for taking additional steps to help protect our youth, help protect our families, and help bringing California back together again.
You mentioned Knott's Berry Farm, and over 4th of July weekend, there were shootings in Illinois as well as in Pennsylvania. Did those shape? I mean, these are large scale events, and I would imagine organizers had taken precautions as well. Did you take additional steps, or what conversations do you have to ensure, as you say, you want to be the safest, what is it, square mile in Sacramento?
Yeah, Cal Expo is 800 acres. So when you think of the size of that piece of property, we have hundreds and hundreds of police officers. We're the only fair in California with our own police chief, our own police jails, which another reason we're called upon during emergencies in the region to support Sac County Sheriff and Sac City PD and Highway Patrol. But because we have such a great working relationship with those other law enforcement agencies, they all come together at the state fair. So whether it's patrol, narcotics, funny money, fake money people, the safest place you can be is at the state fair. There's also 200 surveillance cameras. We are the fallback seat of government for the Capitol. If the Capitol's evacuated, we have our own water, pump our own water and treat it. We have a 1 megawatt solar project on the property, so we can generate a lot of our own electricity. And we'd love to expand that into something bigger to help other government agencies. So again, the safest place you can be. And yes, and directly on your question, we do network across the nation and around the state with other large event facilities, pro sports, as well as large fairs and festivals. And through the pandemic, we were certainly networking on what are you doing as a vaccination site. In our case, we were a drive-through site and we were a sit-down site. We had Kaiser and we had County Health there at the same time. So we were looked at from around the country as one of the first drive-through vaccination sites. And for a number of months, we were the largest testing facility in California until Dodger Stadium opened up.
Mm, yeah. I remember covering the opening at Cal Expo when it was a testing site and then eventually a vaccination site. When it comes to the rule for minors, obviously under the age of 18, how do you know a minor is a minor? I mean, when I go back to before I had a driver's license, you know, I was a freshman in high school, I didn't have like a California ID. How do you determine someone's age?
Well, Vicki, you'd be one of those beautiful people that always looks younger. At the security gates.
Are you requiring identification, though, to go to the state fair?
After 6 o'clock on Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday night, yes.
Got it. Okay, so that's how you're able to determine whether someone is over or under 18 years old. The tickets, yes. You mentioned tickets are being purchased in greater quantities online, which is helping to streamline things, but tickets are $14 for adults, general admission, kids are $10. There's also parking in addition and food, so a day at the fair for a family can easily add up. Can you talk about what a ticket to the state fair includes and what it doesn't include? And are there ways for people to save some money during inflation and budget conscious times?
Absolutely. We want families to come out to the fair. For example, on Mondays, which is our smut giving Mondays, you come out to the fair, you bring 3 cans of non-perishable food and you get in the state fair for free. It's a great opportunity. On Tuesdays, it's kids free day. So kids come in for free. They can ride rides for $2 a ride, which is quite a great discount. When we opened this morning, it's free admission for military personnel, emergency responders, first responders, veterans. So they're coming out to have a great day at the fair. And once you're in the fair, all of our exhibits, things for kids to do, Toytopia, the new cannabis exhibit, those are all free for people to go out and enjoy the state fair farm. You can learn about fish farming. You can learn about how California is trying to adjust to climate change and the drought, how we irrigate our crops. You can go to the animals or the petting zoo. All that's free. But if you want that fantastic fair food, it is a little bit more expensive this year with the price of fuel and the price of labor. However, we kept our fair admissions the same as we had them in 2018 and 2019. So the price to park and the price to get in the door is the same.
And it's probably just important to look on the website and see what deals may fit you, especially if you have children on a Tuesday.
Absolutely. There's so many great opportunities to get in the state fair for free, if not a deep discount. And those people that plan ahead and bought their tickets, either at Costco or one of our ticket outlets in advance, got basically a 30% off discount on admission and parking.
I want to get to something you mentioned about a cannabis competition. It's the first year this is happening at the California State Fair. Just like the annual wine competition, but weed from across the state will be judged and awarded medals. How is cannabis judged and by whom?
I think every Californian judges cannabis to some degree or another, either preconceived notions or things that they've studied or read or heard. But cannabis has been legalized in California. And as the California State Fair, we also celebrate agriculture, which means technology, science, transportation, packaging, marketing, etc. So in the case of cannabis, we created the first of its kind cannabis competition for licensed growers only. The licensed growers had to enter the competition. They had to ship their product to SC Labs in Santa Cruz. And the entire competition was based on chemical composition. Sorry, I don't get in until about 2:30 in the morning during this. Trying to have my coffee and speak.
Yes, but coffee always helps me too.
The chemical composition of cannabis. And there's three main categories: cannabis grown in outdoor light, indoor light, mixed light, and then the lab results generated the winners, whether they're cannabinoids, terpenes, the different compounds that are in it. And then the computer told us who those winners were. And those winners, you can go to our website and view them. You have to check the box to show you're 21 and up. And then that determined those best growers in California based upon the chemical compound of the product. We expect this competition will grow. It will evolve. This is the first year we partnered with a great group called Cultivar, and Colas Cannabis has been a fantastic sponsor. But if you come out to the state fair and you want to see the cannabis exhibit, it is wildly educational. The history of cannabis, not only around the world, but here in California, and then all the different products that cannabis goes into, particularly CBD, hemp, another variety, and from clothing to ropes to other things. And then the concept of cannabis plays such an important role during the AIDS epidemic and now a medicinal role in California. So come on out. If you're 21 years, you will have to show ID to go into it's a Expo Center building number one. It's been the way the exhibit has been done is fantastic. There's no terpenes for sale. There's no smoking of cannabis allowed. We're not handing out gummies we're not doing any of those things that some people thought we were doing. We're educating the public. Cannabis is legal in California. It's rapidly becoming one of the largest crops from an agriculture industry point of view, which means production. The purity of the product is really what the competition was about. So we tied it to SC Labs and chemical compounds.
Got it. Yeah, because I was envisioning, I was like, is there a panel of judges? And then they're either like, you know, rolling something or popping an edible in their mouth. I was like, how many times could you actually do that? But it's actually going to a lab and determining who gets first place and second or a gold medal or things like that.
Absolutely. We're trying to educate people to help lessen the stigmas. As you were talking about, I'm picturing all these judges sitting around in a circle taking a puff. What do you think? That is a stigma, you know. But like anything else that's out there, it's an educational process. And your state fair exists to help showcase the past as well as showcase the future of the people of California.
Yeah. Concerts, also a very big draw at the fair. Who are some of the headliners, the top draws this year?
Well, last night was Casey and the Sunshine Band.
Awesome.
And Casey started out with saying, you know, I'm 71 years old and I'm 71 pounds heavier. And and proceeded to just rock the house. It was phenomenal. Opening night, Chaka Khan, the amount of people that came out, and two distinct audiences who really loved it. Clay Walker the other night, the country crowd came out and danced and sang with their country music. We actually did a tribute band to, it's called 24 Karat, but 24 Karat is a tribute to Bruno Mars. And if you closed your eyes, I mean, nobody is Bruno Mars, right? I mean, he's just an icon. But if you closed your eyes, you actually had the feeling that Bruno Mars was on stage. So those have already happened. We've got great large concerts coming up ahead of us too. TLC is going to do a fantastic job. Chase Rice, so Young Country. And we got a young guy that everybody's excited about named Blanco Brown. Oh. Blanco Brown is Young Country. He's a little bit of a rapper. He did a TikTok video of his get up dance, and it's like 700 million people on TikTok, some outrageous number. And Blanco just happens to be African American. So when you combine rap with Young Country, with high energy, an awesome voice, he's just going to do a great job for everybody.
There is plenty to still explore with about a week and a half left to the California State Fair. Rick, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, and Vicki, thank you for getting the word out about our safety policies, our entertainment, because actually the concerts is something that's free with the price of fair admission. So you can come on out and enjoy a great show, wander around. We call it grazing the food lanes. People just, you know, if it's on a stick or on a plate, you can find it at your California State Fair.
Thank you so much, Rick. Rick Pickering is the CEO of Cal Expo and the California State Fair. Up next, although bullfighting is banned in California, bloodless bullfighting has been a part of the state for decades. We'll learn about how it is steeped in Portuguese culture across the Central Valley, making its debut at the Stanislaus State Fair. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Taking the bull by the horns figuratively means facing a daunting challenge directly and confidently. But in Portuguese culture, that saying is quite literal. While bullfighting is illegal in California, bloodless bullfighting has been legal in the state since the 1950s, a Portuguese spectacle between men and bulls where the animals are not physically harmed. The bullfights have been part of religious festivals in the state, but this month made their debut at the Stanislaus County Fair. We're going to learn more about its cultural significance as well as the history of the Portuguese in the Central Valley. Joining us now from the Turlock Pentecost Association is Clarence Oliveira, who organized the event at the Stanislaus County Fair, and Tony Machado, who has nearly 30 years of Portuguese bullfighting experience. Clarence and Tony, welcome to Insight. Good morning.
How you doing?
Clarence, starting with you, your organization is the Turlock Pentecost Association, and you organized this debut at the California State Fair. Can you tell us more about the association and who you all are?
Well, our association started back in 1912, so we've been around for over 100 years, and we are a Portuguese Catholic organization that started back in the Azores Islands. A lot of our immigrants migrated to California in the late 1800s, and in the early 1900s throughout the Central Valley, created organizations in different cities to celebrate the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit.
Why is bloodless bullfighting important to your group and your culture in the Central Valley?
Well, it's part of our tradition back to the islands. Most islands back in the Azores have a celebration that involves bullfighting through their celebration weekend, which starts after Easter week or Easter Day, I should say. That is kind of the part of the entertainment that is given to the public after the feast of feeding the participants and also the poor. That is tradition of the culture that leads all the way back to Queen Elizabeth, that was the Queen of Portugal.
How was the county fair? It just wrapped up. What went into having this debut in Stanislaus County?
Well, it's been more than just this year. This kind of started back with Matt Cranfield, the CEO of Stanislaus Fair, back in 2019. I was the president back in 2019, and that was something that we started discussion and how we can do something at the fair where we can have multiple entertainers in one arena with multiple audience viewing who we are and what we do. Mm.
Tony, I want to bring you in because you are across the Atlantic. You're actually speaking to us from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, the island of Terceira, which is part of the Azores, which is located roughly 1,000 miles off the coast of Portugal. And I know we're getting some feedback with your Zoom, but you first, can you just start off by describing where you're at? I think you're one of the most unique guests, physically speaking, that we've had on Insight joining us in the middle of the ocean.
I got here, it was 8:30 this morning in Terceira. I'm actually at an uncle's house right now. Here to watch a anniversary bullfight of a group that was participated this year in Turlock Festa, and they've been to Turlock, Pentecost, and California for other bullfights. It's their 15th year anniversary, so I'm here to support them and be here to watch the show.
You have been involved in bullfighting, Portuguese bullfighting, for nearly 30 years. What inspired you to get in the ring?
As a kid, I was around bullfighting from the age of 5-6 years old. I've been around those animals. I learned how to ride horses up there. Working those animals. I work those animals in corrals. I've been around them for many, many years. I started grabbing bulls for the Suicide Squad, which terminology in California, that's what we'd call them, but the right way to call them would be furcados. I started when I was 17 and I retired, I was 46.
And you mentioned that you're at your uncle's house. If you can just kind of talk to us more about your connection to the Azores.
My parents both are born and bred here in Terceira. Neighbors, probably maybe anywhere from 6 to 10 houses apart from one another. I've been here many of times. I've been to the mainland. And it's like home. I feel comfortable here. I have a lot of friends here, some family. But over the years, we've with bullfighting and just mutual friends between me and my family, we know a lot of people here on the island.
What is the cultural significance of these bullfights, given that you've obviously been a part of this for decades, but you have such deep roots to Portuguese culture?
It's a way of entertainment, okay? Like, I'm going to compare it what we do in Turlock. The Festa Week starts on Tuesday with praying the rosary. You pray Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. On Sunday, you go to Mass. On Friday, you have, an entertainment show, whatever it may be. On Saturday, the same thing. On Sunday, you might have just a dance, just a lowercase, you know, type of entertainment. Then you got the bullfight, which you usually entertain anywhere from, 3,000 to about 5,000 people. It's an opportunity to entertain the public, to entertain the people that have helped you support this, the organization. It's a little bit given back to the community as an entertainment type of deal. Mm.
What brought you to the Central Valley in California?
Well, I was born and bred. My parents moved here, moved to the States in 72. I was born in 73. Just been a part of it. My parents have always been tied to Turlock Pentecost, not so much as a president or anything like that, but always part of the background scene on the helping. Just something I got into it in the last, on the bullfight part, I've always supported Turlock. And then about 2012, Bobby Estacio had brought me in as a director, got me involved. Pretty much everybody that I know and I've known for a long time, I've been involved there at Turlock. They got me wrapped into it. And then in 2021, they invited me to take over as vice president for the president and his wife that was at that time, which was Nelson Fonts and Julia. And we went to, we went ahead and did our year. It was very successful. A lot of support from the community, from our families, our friends, our organization. So it was a good experience. It was something that I don't regret what I did on making that decision, because I did it at a time that I could still enjoy it. Hmm.
You know, although these fights are marketed as bloodless and the state has banned bullfighting back in the 1950s, but bloodless bullfighting is still legal in California, which is why it's ongoing. Obviously, some animal rights groups in California and nationally have criticized this tradition. I mean, most notably PETA, saying both the bulls and the horses that are used are tormented and nothing more than objects. What is your response to those sentiments?
Number one, when we don't know too much about a certain thing, we should ask questions and educate ourselves a little bit. Because in every aspect of other people do and what we do, there is a reason, there's an explanation. These animals that are, speaking on the bulls, these animals are born and bred to bullfight. Okay. They are bred and fought to see their nobility, how good they are, their aggression, how true the bull is to what we want to see. And for the bull owners, they take the very best and continue the breeding to make it even that much better. On the horses part, these animals are different bloodlines. You got Lusitanos, you got Arabians, you got quarter horses that do bullfight, more Lusitanos. These horses are very well taken care of. If I had video, I would show you. These animals, they go to the gym, you know, basically they get a workout. They're unsaddled, they're washed, they're taken care of. They're the athletes. They're not mistreated. They're not, abused. They're like when these owners that own these horses, they treat them as they're not a tool. They become, it's more than even a pet. They become part of a team, a part of a brotherhood, but I mean, those animals are very well taken care of. I mean, any little thing, any little scratch, anything, these animals are right away, right on top of them. The vet's out there checking them. If you had the opportunity to see it with your own eyes, you'd be like, wow, these guys really don't screw around with this. They really take care of these animals. It's really interesting to see how well these animals are taken care of, even with the bulls, because these bulls are, they're in a habitat that nobody's messing with. They have shade, they have fresh water, they're fed, they're maintained. If something comes up wrong with them, they're brought in, taken care of. If you would actually see some of the situations, that you would be like, there is no abuse. There is no, there's just no abuse. They're very well taken care of. And it'd be nice to, you know, to see that one day if you ever had the opportunity.
From my understanding, what makes it bloodless is that there's Velcro that's used, correct? Like there's a blanket of Velcro over the bull, and then something that is kind of like a rod or a stick that has Velcro attached. And is that what makes it bloodless as opposed to a sharp object?
There's a basically like a blanket. It's like 18 by 24 inches long. It's all Velcro. And then they put these sticks that they put on the animal, and the very end of the sticks, they are completely Velcro. So basically, when the stick is put on the bull's back and it like lays over, it actually looks like it's, you know, what they do in Spain, you know what I mean? But it's really not. There is no blood. There's no nail. There's no nothing. It just looks like it's, you know, in the animal, but it's not. It's just laying on top of that Velcro. It's not affecting the animal. It's not, because if you've ever seen a bullfight, what the horseman uses the horses at is like a cape. He doesn't want that animal to get hit. So he uses the horse as a cape, and the horse shows by his training how well that he maneuvers in front of that animal. And he can make that bull miss him by just his maneuvering. And that's the whole thing about bullfighting. It's not for one animal to hit the other. That's not the game plan. Mm. The whole game plan is to present the horse in front of the bull, and that horse and the rider make the bull miss as a way of tiring him out for the fricados, but it's not to abuse the animal by no means.
Clarence Oliveira is with the Turlock Pentecost Association. Clarence, thank you for joining us and for organizing this event at the Stanislaus County Fair this year. And Tony Machado is joining us from the Azores, 1,000 miles off the coast of Portuguese. And he has nearly 30 years of Portuguese bullfighting experience. Thank you both for joining us, especially Tony, you know, on an island in the middle of the Atlantic.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're learning more about bloodless bullfighting in California, which made its debut at the Stanislaus County Fair. We're going to continue the conversation on this subject by getting a better understanding of Portuguese culture in the Central Valley. To provide more context and background, we've invited Dennis Borges with the Portuguese Beyond Borders Institute at Fresno State. Dennis, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, Vicky. Appreciate it.
First of all, let's unpack the Portuguese Beyond Borders Institute and the history project that you're working on.
We are working on a history project, oral history, basically. So PBBI from Fresno State is about 3 years old. And our main mission is to collect the oral history of the Portuguese American experience in California, which is just not an experience, as both of your previous guests mentioned. It's not an experience of just someone who immigrated. It's also a second, third, fourth, and even fifth generation experience, multi-generational. So we're capturing the history of the Portuguese Americans in California through oral history. We have a speaker and a conference series. We have a publishing house, and we also have a Portuguese language program to promote the teaching of the Portuguese language and culture at Valley High Schools.
What brought Portuguese Americans to the Central Valley?
Economics, like what brings many folks from different parts of the world. We all share in that common history of coming to America and having a better opportunity. and the Azores of certainly the Azores of the end of the 18th century was a very challenging place, and even the Azores of the 20th century. We live in the middle of the Atlantic, as you mentioned. Today's Azores are completely different than they were even 30 or 40 years ago. But when I came to California at the age of 10 in 1968, it was not the same place that it is today. And so we had a couple of, we had a very long running dictatorship that was brutal to the Azores. And so economics, civil liberties were the main reasons.
Would you say that an overwhelming majority of Portuguese Americans in California or the Central Valley came from the Azores?
Correct. We don't have exact numbers, Vicky. We have numbers from the U.S. Census that give the number of Californians of Portuguese background around 350,000. By our best estimates, everybody in the academic world, we're looking around 85 to 90% from the Azores.
Oh, yeah, that's significant. What has been the most fascinating part of this history project that you're working on?
Well, the most fascinating history part of it has been basically to see how the culture continues in second and third generations with different nuances. Obviously, some things are done here that they are not done in Portugal. So it's been wonderful to register these stories, to talk to folks, especially the elder generation, those 65 plus who were already born here. It was their parents or their grandparents, in some cases their great-grandparents that immigrated, yet they feel a strong connection. I mean, I have one gentleman that I recall with lots of emotion, 93 years old. I was lucky to capture his story before he passed last year. And he said his only regret was not having gone to his homeland, although it was his grandfather that immigrated, but he felt it was still his homeland. So the connection that folks have, even though they were born here or their parents were born here, is really amazing, and how they've been able to incorporate different elements into the different celebrations and events that involve other cultures. That to me has been a surprise, and in one way, another way, I've been studying this for just about all my life, but it's been wonderful to see how folks have been able to continue past the immigrant generation.
Dennis, thank you so much for joining
thank
us.
You.
I think a lot of us learned a lot today, myself included. Dennis Borges is the director of the Portuguese Beyond Borders Institute at Fresno State, discussing Portuguese culture in California, specifically the Central Valley. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Since 2020, business owners in the Tahoe Basin have had one hurdle after another to keep their staff employed and their doors open. An ongoing and ever-evolving pandemic, wildfire, logjam supply chains, inflations, and a cost of living adding more pressure to the service industry, which is an essential pillar to Tahoe's economic well-being. In the past 2 years, we've checked in a couple times with Alex Hunt, the owner of Mountain Slice Cafe and Creamery on Lake Tahoe's West Shore. Alex joins us once again about the challenges that lay ahead for him and other businesses in the Tahoe region. Alex, good morning. Welcome back to Insight.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us again. When you first joined us on Insight, it was May of 2020, I believe, and you were faced with the possibility of closing your business temporarily or even perhaps permanently. 2 years plus, you're still in business. How do you reflect on the last 2 years, and what stands out to you the most?
Yeah, we're still here. So it's been a wild ride. You know, back when we were talking, we're located here in Tahoe City, and us, and along with a lot of the other business owners, local business owners here, we were just really kind of struggling to figure out how to keep the doors open, how to get creative, like a lot of places were across the country, to really, you know, keep things sustainable for the employees that you had on and for yourself, just to keep your doors open. And, you know, at the time, it wasn't even a, you know, a matter of kind of turning a profit. It was just a matter of being able to, you know, stay open and be able to provide a service to the community, because we didn't really know what was going to happen. And you know, throughout everything that's gone on in the last, you know, 2+ years, I will say the adaptability of our town here in Tahoe City and in the Tahoe Basin in general, because we are a very tourist-driven town, the adaptability that everyone, you know, has kind of collectively come to really embrace and encompass as far as trying to bring people back to Tahoe and everything like that has been phenomenal. And I think, you know, we've really taken it in stride. Granted, there's been a few businesses across the board here that have closed, but some of those businesses that have closed has just been due to a change of ownership or whatever it may be. And whether or not that's a product of COVID, I can't really say one way or the other, but it's been very remarkable to see the resilience of our little town here, for sure.
With hindsight being 2020, if you were able to go back to yourself at March of 2020 and give yourself one word of advice or a piece of advice, what would you tell yourself?
Ooh, I would tell myself that there is light at the end of the tunnel. You know, in the beginning, it just looked very bleak. We didn't really know what to expect, like I said, and we were really trying to find ways to keep things moving forward in a time that felt very, very stagnant right then and there. It just felt like we were stuck and we didn't really know what to do. And a lot of the cities and the county ordinances were, you know, coming in and out, and there was a lot of confusion there, and to no one's fault, because everything was so new, but it was just really hard for us as business owners to keep having to, like, we felt bend over backwards with a lot of these new restrictions. And it's not that we weren't willing to, but it was just something new that was almost contradictory to something else that had come up the week before. And so that was a real hard thing for us to kind of get through. And so what I would tell myself back then is just, you know, keep your head down, everything will work out, and just stay resilient like we had been, and not worry too much about it. The community really came out to support us. We tried to do a lot of interesting things, like a lot of the other pizza places here in the city did. So it's you know, it worked out, and I would just tell myself, you know, keep calm and move forward.
The challenges have just continued from the Caldor fire last year to now even economic issues from inflation and supply chain shortages. The Lake Tahoe Visitors Authority told CAP Radio that visitors who are going to Tahoe should expect shorter hours, less menu items. Have you had to make any of those similar cutbacks or changes?
Yeah, definitely. You know, in regards to the fire, shout out to Cal Fire and all those guys keeping us safe, and everybody protecting us on all those front lines. You know, this year has been a blessing for us so far. We haven't really seen anything too much here in our area, besides that Yosemite fire that was to the south of us. Other than that, this year has been great, and everyone's been doing a real good job as far as being fire safe. So we haven't really had to worry about people coming up and reducing their activities outside and reducing their time outside in that regard. So we've been seeing a lot of foot traffic and everything in that space. The one thing that we're, you know, kind of coupled with now, you know, is the supply chain issues and the housing shortages and stuff like that. Finding employees has always been kind of a little bit of a issue up here, us being a very small town and being a very much a ski town. And so you get a lot of people that are here for a season and out for a season. Luckily, I've been able to retain amazing staff. I've got really good employees that have been with me for a long time that are loyal to the shop. And I've got a lot of respect for them, and it's mutual. And so we all work together real well. And so that, as far as on that end, that hasn't been too big of a problem for me, but I know that's been a huge struggle, you know, that coupled with the housing that everyone's mm-hmm. been kind of struggling with has been, you know, real difficult for employers to keep employees. And I know that's been an issue. And then inflation's been the hard part too up here with supply chain issues. And, you know, because we are in a little bit more of a remote area, things are always a little bit more expensive up here, and now even more so, you know, as it is across the board, you know, throughout most of the nation. And so we're kind of dealing with that trade-off of having to pass some of that down to the consumer, but also understanding that, you know, people do have to drive up here. Gas prices are very expensive right now. And so we don't want to, you know, make it too heavy and hard, but at the same time, the cost of living is going up across the board. And so we do take that into account. And so we're just trying to make it fair and reasonable for everybody so that we can keep bringing people in through the doors without having to make them feel like, you know, when they leave that they spent more than they should and it wasn't, you know, they weren't getting the value and the bang for their buck.
I mean, I'm reminded of a conversation we had just this past spring in March with the Tahoe Prosperity Center. And it was about a survey of people living and working across the Tahoe Basin. And they found that 6 out of 10 residents said the region is on the wrong track. Where do you stand with that question? Especially, you really touched upon the affordability issue and the cost of living for people who are not tourists, but locals.
You know, people ask about optimism and you know, where I lie as far as an optimistic view for the future up here. And it's hard to say. There's been so many changes that has happened through COVID. And it's not to say that our community hasn't come through to the other side, because we have, but we're still trying to find that balance now with the influx of people moving to the area now that remote working is becoming a more of the norm for more and more companies as it becomes more feasible. And so finding that balance of the housing being snatched up where we can't necessarily maintain a labor workforce up here, it is hard. And my optimism really lies in kind of just the day-to-day, just to make sure that we can keep doing what we're doing. And we do have a strong community up here of locals, and a lot of the locals up here tend to look out for each other. And so we try to band together when times are tough. And right now in the housing scheme of things, times are tough. You know, it, as far as the cost of living goes, times are tough, you know, gas prices, times are tough. So am I optimistic for the future? I will say I am. I'm always optimistic for the future. I'm still breathing. I've got a roof over my head. I've got great employees, great friends. I play in a great band mm-hmm. right now. Pipe Down, shout out. But
Pipe
I just,
Down?
Yes, ma'am. Little reggae band. That was a little combination of COVID and everything too that came out of it as well. And so there is good to be had from all of this. And so I am optimistic for the future. There's just things that we need to work on as a community collectively so we can get there, as far as housing goes, as far as maintaining a sibilance between the tourists that come up and the locals. Because of everything that has come up, there has been that tendency for the locals to kind of shun the people that do come up, because, you know, we do deal with a lot of trash and a lot of pollution and
stuff.
Not
everyone's respectful, right?
Exactly. And so that's something that we do have a little bit of animosity towards when it comes to the people coming up, and that hatred kind of boils over sometimes. And we need to really learn how to, you know, they're going to be here. And so we just need to learn how to cohabitate and just make sure that we can keep everybody happy, keep our doors open, keep everybody on the same page as far as Tahoe's here. It's a beautiful place, and we want to maintain that. And we want to maintain the local businesses here because they're the ones that keep this place running. They're the ones that give it its charm. We're the ones that are really trying to do what we can for the community when the community needs it.
Before we let you go, we just have about 10 seconds or so left. I'm just curious, what's your favorite pizza? We head up to Mountain Slice. What should we order?
Oh man, my favorite pizza. I'm a New Yorker, so I'm from New Jersey and New York. So my favorite slice is a cheese slice, but you got to come get one of our specialty slices, the bee sting with jalapeno sausage, fresh drizzle of our hot honey that we make in house, and fresh garlic. That's one of our more popular ones.
And you can get it by the slice too?
You can get it by the slice till 5 o'clock, and then we do whole pies all until 7:30. We make a limited amount of dough because I'm a very small restaurant, so I do sell out every day. Place your orders early, guys, and we'll make sure we get it to you.
Alex, thank you for an on-the-ground level and a look at what's happening in Tahoe.
Hey, you guys are awesome. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it, and let's do it again soon.
Yeah, and maybe listen to Pipe Down soon.
Hey, listen to Pipe Down. We got a bunch of shows coming up. We got a river show coming up here locally on the 30th. It's going to be a blast with some local bands coming through too. Check it out, guys.
Alex Hunt is the owner of Mountain Slice Cafe and Creamery in Tahoe City. That is it for Insight today. You can learn about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you next week.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.